Hi there, welcome back into the TV podcast. We have hit the three-quarter pole in season one of HBO's show Perry Mason. I am your host, Devin Higgins, and I am joined this week by another first-timer to the TV ranks, all the way from Dallas, Texas, by way of New York City. His name is James Farner. James, how are you doing tonight?
Good. Thanks so much for having me here. I have to say, I've been really enjoying the show so far, listening along every week, and it's really nice to be invited on.
Well, flattery really gets you somewhere. So before we dive too far into this, because we do have a lot to cover again in this hour or so, why don't you give me a little bit of background of your interest in the show? What got you into Perry Mason? Were you a fan of the old show, or where are you, what's your point of access for this revival of it?
Yeah, so meaning no offense to anyone, but I'm far too young to be a fan of the original show. That is well before my time. But I'm a fan of detective shows in general. I was a big fan of True Detective on HBO, and I liked their Outsider adaptation that they did recently. So when I saw that HBO had this on their schedule, it piqued my interest without knowing anything about Perry Mason other than that he was a detective coming to HBO, which, of course, a little research turns out that he is not historically known for being a detective, but rather a lawyer. But that wasn't enough to turn me off. I was still interested. And I've actually been watching every week with my girlfriend and her father, and he is a fan of the original show. So I've gotten a little bit of that perspective at the beginning, him saying, you know, oh, Della, I remember her, and such.
Okay, well, through the first five episodes, what has been your take on it? If you can, you've just kind of encapsulate it and kind of give us your take on what you've experienced to this point.
Yeah, I would say that so far, I think I've liked almost every episode more than what came before, which is a really good trend. The first episode, honestly, I was a little back and forth on after first watching it. It has such a dark opening, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it was not quite what I was expecting. But as they've delved more into the mystery angle with the investigations, and particularly, as I'm sure we'll talk about this episode, with the actual courtroom drama, it's gotten to be very interesting and has lived up to my hopes so far. And hopefully they stick the landing.
Well, and they don't have a whole lot of time left as
no,
we are six
don't.
Of eight episodes in. So with that out of the way, why don't we jump into the synopsis as we flashcast this puppy? Because again, it's a lot that they cram into these 60 minutes.
Absolutely.
For us to go through. So the synopsis for chapter six of eight is as follows. As James alludes to, the Emily Dodson trial gets underway in this episode, finally. Doesn't get off to the best start as Perry struggles to deliver his opening statement and DA Maynard Barnes calls a surprise witness, the hotel manager who testifies that Charlie was placed alone in a room with George Gannon and Emily off in another room having a bit of a tryst. Elsewhere, Pete Strickland uncovers evidence suggesting Gannon was stealing from Sister Alice's church. Again, he was the accountant for the church. He also encourages Perry to use the dentures that he got from Paul Drake in court, but Perry wants to keep his promise he made when he got them. Perry attempts to get Drake to mention them himself during cross-examination of his testimony to no avail, but after Paul gets paid off by his commander for his testimony, Drake pays Mason a visit at his house, determined to help, and gives Mason an official evidence envelope so he can present the dentures in court. However, the judge rules them inadmissible, and Perry accuses both the judge and the DA of trying to intentionally torpedo his case. Meanwhile, Della Street uses Strickland's information to find evidence implicating Baggerly, while Pete finds some major evidence about Elder Seidel with shady business dealings from the Ludlow Coal Massacre in Colorado in 1914. But as Barnes's final witness, the jail matron, falsely testifies to overhearing a confession by Emily that she killed her baby Charlie Dodson, chaos erupts in the court. Mason has one final lead to track down, thanks to an address procured by Della, and finds a man out in the middle of nowhere named Jim Hicks, who's connected to the case. He tells Perry he's been waiting for him to show up at his door while Jim is holding a rifle. And that is where we pick up with Chapter 6. So, for me, what really irked me, or what I should say, what was uncomfortable right out the gate was what happened in court.
Yeah.
Because, man, that was painful.
My very first thought when the episode started was, wow, Perry looks really good. He looks great. The best that he's looked all season, cleaned up. And then he gets up there and totally stumbles. He's coughing and choking. And like you said, it's kind of painful and not what we expect from him. He says later to Pete that when he practices at home, it's fine. He knows what he's going to say. It all comes out. But as soon as he gets up in the courtroom, that's where his body doesn't do what his mind is telling it to do. And for someone who is well known as becoming the lawyer, that's the direction we know he's headed in. That's not a happy start to his career, for sure.
No, on the one hand, I did like to see Perry stumble out of the gate. Again, and I'm sure your girlfriend's dad can attest to this, that having seen the original series, one thing you never saw Perry Mason really be was rattled.
Sure. And if we're doing a prequel, you know, that's the time where you would see him coming into his own and having these struggles before he is a well-renowned lawyer.
It's the awkwardness of it, and even the subsequent court scenes after this, with the one exception of when Paul is on the stand.
Right.
The first time I watched it, I had to fast forward through them. And I guess part of it for me was having, as I've said throughout this, having once many moons ago worked for a defense attorney and been in courts where this sort of stuff has happened, part of it was out of flashback and just out of muscle memory to just be, oh, I remember this. The other part is just you see Perry so much on the back foot.
Sure.
And when he expects to get some consolation, he gets a little bit from Della, but Pete isn't too thrilled about it.
No, he's not. And that leads to, I think, the first really good scene that I loved of the episode, which is the three of them, where they are arguing about how it went in court and what the next steps are. And Della really has to take control.
Yeah, once again, she's the adult in the room. She had to do that when EB was still alive and he and Perry were going at it. Now that it's just Perry, Pete, and her, she's still got to be the one to keep them on course.
Exactly. She's the one who has her sights set on the real goal, getting Emily out of prison, off of the charges. And she has not really wavered in any way from that goal versus the two men who get very distracted with their egos and their frustrations, and they let it all get to them. But Della is the voice of reason, and it's really nice to see how well she holds a room and holds her own against these men, and really sets the example that Perry's going to need to follow going forward if he's going to successfully pull off this trial.
Yeah, for all that we have seen with Della, the emotional consistency of her, where she's had moments where she does let her guard down and get flustered when she's alone with Hazel, who I did like that little moment in there.
He's working in the office,
and,
yep.
And Pete's walking out the door in later gloves. Toodaloo, Pete.
Yeah.
The chemistry between these three is so strong. And as Kirk, my co-host last week, mentioned, it is a situation now where, if you've been following along with this, the person that you are the most worried about is Pete.
Yeah.
And he does a lot of heavy lifting in this episode.
Absolutely.
And Shea Whigham, to his credit, the scene that comes later on when he and Perry, Matthew Reese, are standing on the porch and he carries the whole conversation. It's the way it's written was really well done, because it's just Pete talking to himself as Perry would if he's telling him what he wants to hear.
Well, and we also see the more humble side of Pete in that conversation where he says, you know, well, what should I do in court tomorrow, Pete? I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I don't have all the answers. But here's what I do have, and here is what I can do to support you, and here's what I need from you. Get me to Denver. Get me to check in on the lead that we found on these people, and I will pull through for you.
And Perry's conflict is, of course, that when he got the evidence from Paul Drake, he got it with the caveat that Drake said, if you call me out on it, I'm going to deny the whole thing.
Right.
And that put Perry in the difficult situation of having to back that up.
And he gave Drake his word, and he says that to Pete, you know, I gave him my word. And Pete says, what did you give to Emily? Which I thought was a great line.
It was. Well, and also how Pete's attitude towards not just Drake's maneuvering in that, but that also in Pete's eyes makes him a bad cop.
Right.
It makes him no different than Innes, potentially no different than Holcomb, and everybody else who is out there waving a badge around to get their own. He makes it very clear, I got no stomach for these.
Yeah,
people.
And
so we know that... We know that Pete's a man of principle, even as he's walking through looking for the mythic garage over at George Dodson's place. We see him cutting corners, and he snags the mail. He will cut corners when necessary, but he still holds on to his convictions, which seems to be a very constant thing throughout this whole series.
Yep, there's what's legal and there's what's right, and that's a guiding line for all of them at this point.
It was interesting watching Perry when we get back to court. And Matthew Dodson is on the stand.
Yes, the excellent Perry's redeeming scene in the court.
To an extent. We have Maynard Barnes, again, played by the excellent Stephen Root, and the judge, played by the excellent Matt Frewer, who are there anchoring this scene, and Stephen Root is guiding Matthew Dodson through his testimony and making sure to embellish it in the way that DAs do and getting exactly what he wants the jury to hear. That's an old maxim I remember hearing as a paralegal was, no lawyer walks into court without questions he doesn't already know the answer to. So it's a matter of being able to play it so you can get what you need out of your witness, whether it be your prosecutor or defense. And I don't think Barnes was ready for when Perry got up there and dressed down Dodson, which was great.
No. And Perry's finally starting to dig into some of those slightly dirty tricks as well in getting him to confess to lying to the police, to withholding information from his wife. Those are the same sort of character flaws that the DA has been pointing out in Emily the whole time.
He's having to learn the rules of the game on the fly.
Yes, as the judge notes several times.
Right, but also part of his Achilles heel was that he learned from E.B. Jonathan, who was a byproduct of an earlier era, and that was part of his downfall, where he was watching the rules of the game change around him, and he couldn't keep up with it.
Right.
Perry is doing the same thing, but he is young enough and he is driven enough that it looks like he's going to find a way to get through it because the case demands that he does. But it's not going to be easy.
No, it certainly is not. And he definitely, at this point, even after his successful cross-examination, he still doesn't really think of himself as a good lawyer yet.
No, especially after the next witness, who is this hotel manager that we had no
yes.
reference to at all, comes in and completely poleaxes the defense because the manager testifies that his hotel was where George Gannon and Emily got together to have their affair, and at one point Charlie was in the next room while the affair was going on.
Right.
Perry doesn't take that well.
No, and it's hard to blame him for that because he's so blindsided. He certainly does not react that well in his screaming match with Emily. But I do think that his main point that she needs to tell him everything so that he's not blindsided is a really important point that up till now she clearly has not been fully cooperating, fully complying, giving everything, or he would know and would be ready.
A lawyer is only as good as the information their client gives them.
Exactly.
And if you're withholding stuff that could potentially torpedo your case, that's on you. And the attorney has every right to take a pound out of you.
Yep.
For doing that, because not only does it incredibly impact the case, but it also makes them look stupid and inept to the jury, which matters. We don't want to think that that sort of stuff matters.
Well, but Della would be the first to point out that it sure does with her jury watching.
I do like that little nugget. The case is going on. You see her sketching out the jurists, paying a very sharp eye. She is judging the crowd.
She's watching them to see who they're watching.
I don't, and again, my knowledge of the original 50s, 60s series is extremely limited, albeit I'm sadly a little bit older than you. Not as old as your girlfriend's dad, I hope.
Just a little.
But I don't recall that being an aspect of Della's character in that version of it. So how they've taken a little aspect of it to help flesh her out and make her a little bit more competent, they could have very easily just made her a gallery fly.
Absolutely. And they also accomplish quite a few things with the very brief moment where she discusses it with Perry, because it turns out that it's not actually Perry that the particular juror that she was watching at that time is responding poorly to, but rather Emily, who is acting fidgety and upset, and Della at least says she's acting guilty, and the juror is watching her. So it's not just Perry who's floundering in court, it's the whole team.
Well, and as we'll see later on, Emily has been teetering on a very dangerous precipice for the last couple of episodes, and it seems like she's inching closer and closer.
She is ready to take the plunge.
But the person who's there to try and catch her is Sister Alice, and although we don't see a ton of her in this episode, because for the most part she's a gallery flower, and that's something Perry calls her out on, it's a conversation after he dresses down Emily and Sister Alice catches him on his way out the door. The last time these two were talking, it was a bit more adversarial because Perry was still the investigator and he was still trying to get answers from her and the elders. Now it's just the two of them with the focus on what can we do to help Emily.
They certainly had a new dynamic in that conversation. And it's hard, I think, to pin down quite what it was yet. There was some speculation with my watching crowd whether or not it was a potential romantic or sexual tension between them. But there's certainly something there that was not there in the earlier episodes.
No. And I think there was the point where she asked the question of Perry, isn't there anything that you've ever done that you regret? And Perry looks at her, of course there is. What about you? And she goes, absolutely. They understand that they're at a point in their lives where they've had to take a long journey to get to where they are.
Right.
And I agree with you. I don't, and I certainly hope it isn't, and I can't. There's nothing that has been built up from episode one to now that leads me to think that this could go in any sort of romantic way. They seem very much kindred spirits, albeit from two totally different disciplines.
Right. And I think part of it may also be their realization that despite ending up in very different places, they're really not so different.
The one major difference between the two is, in Perry's case, his parents and most of his family are long gone. In Sister Alice's case, she still has her mother to deal with, and that comes to a head. She's still trying to figure out what she's going to do to pull off her stunt of bringing Charlie Dodson back on Easter Sunday.
10 days out, I think, from this episode.
As the still protesting Elder Brown notes in the 1 minute that he's in this episode.
Yes.
Still in front of his billboard, still shouting. Her mother clearly understands that they have overplayed their hand, and she's already formulated the exit strategy, or a couple of them.
She is clearly ready to go at the drop of a hat. The suitcases are packed. She's ready. She's trying to convince Sister Alice that it is time to get ready to bail and that they need to leave before Easter, because it's not just the elders. You know, she says that there's a whole crowd of people who are eager for them to be shown as fools when Easter comes and she can't raise the baby.
And when Alice pushes back on it, she gets slapped. And that, the look on Tatiana Maslany's face when that happens, it's, she goes from being the person that she thought was in control to very much a petulant child. Because her immediate response is, this church is mine.
Yes. Yeah, talking about dynamics between characters, the one between Sister Alice and her mother is really interesting, and they certainly can change whoever is in control of a conversation between the two of them at any moment.
As we've seen throughout the series, Alice has been straining against the controls that have been put over her. And now that Elder Brown is gone and the other elders have seemingly capitulated more control of the church to her as they're focused on the trial and other things, she's trying to capitalize on that to the highest amount possible without realizing the danger that puts her in.
Right. And she is at her most powerful when she is in front of crowds, people who adore her, when she has the microphone. She's at her least powerful when she is one-on-one with her mother or situations like that.
There almost seems to be a point, and we may see it go this way or not, where we see that power shift twist where she's at her most vulnerable when she's at the microphone.
Right.
I don't know. It's certainly a possibility. They haven't inferred or given any foreshadowing of it. But when you have somebody in this position who is relying so much on their voice and their ability to get people to listen to what they're saying, and you go too far, the ability to turn your back and turn that person off and cut them off from their audience is so fast. In a lot of ways, it's frightening how fast it can be, and it doesn't take much. And I work in media for a living. I've seen it more times than I can count.
Yeah, and she's certainly headed for a situation primed for those sorts of troubles.
We need to talk about Paul Drake.
Yes.
We see Paul Drake two different ways in this episode. We see him as the stalwart cop on the stand, and then we see him after that when he fully understands what that means for him. And this was far and away my favorite section of this episode. What about you?
Yeah, I think particularly the scene between him and Perry, which we'll probably get to momentarily, was probably the high point of the episode for me.
We start with Paul on the stand explaining to, at Mater Barnes' request, he was the one who subpoenaed him. It gave him a chance to explain what he saw through the additional help of Detective Ennis, who, again, is strategically placed right off the aisle in clear view of him, so he knows exactly what he needs to say and how he needs to say it. So he's under the gun with out a gun being there.
Right. And to the end, he perjures himself.
And when Perry gets up there, they spend a lot of time looking at the envelope that has the evidence that Paul gave him in it. And obviously they do this for the effect you want to get of, is Perry going to pull it? Is he not? He starts to lean that way, and you see him leaning that way, and the conflict that is there between him and Paul is palpable. And instead he pivots and goes on the idea of, okay, well, walk me back through the scene, tell me what you saw. And then when he explains the blood trail, he get, you know, how long do you think it was? Well, 40 feet. Okay. And then he walks it off. And Perry does a very smart thing when he gets it, because he goes right out in the middle of the gallery and Ennis is right there, and when he asks the question, he sidesteps right in front of him, so Ennis can't see Drake, Drake can't see Ennis, and it's like, I'm going to shield you from this guy because I know what's up. And as you mentioned, that comes later after Perry has gone home, the trial is dismissed for the day, he gets a knock at the door, and it's Drake.
And they have a wonderful conversation, a real heart-to-heart at that point. That starts, you know, with Drake saying, do you know fear? And Perry says, of course, yes, I was in the war. But then Drake goes on to say, you know, but you don't know fear, the fear that I know, the everyday fear of being a black man in 1930s Los Angeles.
And even a couple of steps back before they get that, and I totally agree, that part of the conversation was awesome. It was pitch perfect. Drake calls him out and says, you know, I wanted to say it. If you had asked me, I would have said it. And Perry tells him, I gave you my word I wasn't going to. And he's kind of kicking himself over it. And Drake kind of eases him a little bit and says, but you did keep your word. And I think because of that, because Drake realizes in Perry there's a guy who will not undercut his own values and his ethics to make himself look better at the expense of other people, then Drake realizes, okay, this is a guy that I can be straight with because he's been straight with me. And the racial dynamic of that included, because you're right, war is one thing. Being a black man in America in the 1930s, as Paul so eloquently lays it out, is something totally different. And when he looks at Perry and says, do you understand what that's like? And Perry can only shake his head and go, I don't have a clue.
Right, and particularly you also have that police officer element to it, where Drake talks about how even as a black police officer, he's not allowed to arrest white people. And he says, you know, a white murderer has more respect than I do.
It's a damning observation and a wholly accurate one. And when he pulls out the envelope that the watch commander gave him for his payoff, he says to Perry, I don't like feeling owned. There is so much behind that statement that has leagues to more to do than just the money, because that is what African-American people have had to deal with.
So much.
And knowing that they still have to operate in a predominantly white majority owned and operated world, and that they can only do so much without the express approval of the white people above them, sure, you're going to feel like you are owned, which for any proud man or woman is a crap feeling.
Absolutely.
Nobody wants to feel
and
that way.
And particularly on top of, it's a whole string of events, because he got the paid off money from the watch commander, but he also, when he first walks out of court, has to look at Perry, stare at him, and has to walk past Ennis, who kind of gives him that nod, like, you did the thing that I wanted you to do. And when you think back to the scene between Ennis and Drake and his wife, there's that dynamic between the two of them, which leads right into Drake sending his wife away to be safe before he agrees to help Perry.
Right. And the conversation between them is brief, and she's still kind of questioning his motive behind this. And he, again, lays it out very succinctly. It's, I have to do right by this, and I can't have you be here and our child be here while I'm doing this. It's, you got to trust me on it. I need to make sure you're safe and that Ennis can't get to you. And it sets the table for a lot of things that we see towards the end of this, especially with Barnes trying to prep Ennis for his testimony. That doesn't go well either, but not in the way that we expected it to, because he just doesn't care.
Right. And Barnes really goes hard on him in the prep session in a way that, I don't know, that I didn't expect, at least, even though we had that scene with him, with Barnes and the detectives in the bathroom in one of the earlier episodes, establishing Barnes's dynamic above them. But even here, he really lays into Ennis.
Well, and so does Holcomb.
Yes, right, exactly. And his partner, and which builds to something later. But at least in this moment, you're seeing the betrayal that Holcomb feels, and the, I think in some ways, fear and anger, and as he's starting to suspect what might actually be going on.
Yeah, there's quite a few switchbacks in this episode of where you expect it to go one way, and then they're not drastic. There are little things that just kind of turn a little bit and make you go, okay, now these puzzle pieces are lining up a little bit more, but now we're seeing a little bit more of the overall picture, which you need in stories like this. And with Holcomb for 90% of this episode, we see him very skeptical of Ennis, trying to figure out what the heck is going on with his partner. And then when he finally confronts Ennis over it at their house, we expect him to take the stand that a good cop would, and instead, Holcomb ends it by going, okay, who else knows about this? Because we got to kill him.
Right. And particularly, that comes right after he starts to hit Ennis's car over and over with the hammer off the wall. And in that moment where he takes the hammer off the wall, I was wondering, you know, is he about to hit Ennis? What is his plan here? And then he gets all violent on the car,
which his wife said was his real love.
Right. And then he slows down again, sort of collects himself, and you start to wonder, well, okay, are you going to arrest him? Are you going to take him in? Are you going to try and help him cover it up? It's unclear. Because he's still fishing for answers, you know, who else knows? And Ennis says, do you really want to know? And then he has that last turn, and it's, no, I want them dead.
I genuinely didn't expect Holcomb to walk out of that garage alive. I thought Ennis was going to kill him. Before that moment,
I thought one of the two might.
Yeah, that could have happened as well, but especially after he starts going to town on the car.
Well, and we still don't know that, you know, there could be some payback down the road still.
In the meantime, Della and Pete are having to make sure that they can find whatever they can to help Perry's case out. And there was that moment in the initial conversation after the opening statement where Della is having to explain to Perry what they need to get done. And Perry's like, okay, well, we'll just go do it. And she has to stop and go, no, you can't do that. You are the attorney. The investigator goes and does that. That's Pete's job. Have him go do it. And even before that, we also find out that George Gannon's life with the church was not as altruistic as it was first implied, because thanks to Pete, they find out that Gannon was swindling money out of the church, which Della later uses to find out even more dirt.
Yeah, there's clearly a lot more going on with the church than we have been let in on so far. And clearly there is some sort of criminal element going on related to the church that ultimately is somehow going to have to tie into the murder of the baby.
Yeah, and we still are no closer to really unraveling that mystery yet.
No.
And that was a real bone of contention during the argument between Pete and Emily, or Perry and Emily, where as he's ripping into her, she comes back and says, well, what have you done to find who Charlie's killer is? You promised me you were going to do that, and you still don't know. And Perry doesn't have an answer.
No, and he berates himself in his EB voice for that later.
I did. I got a genuine kick out of that. Listening to Matthew Reese try and do a good Lithgow impression was quite amusing.
It was better than I would have expected.
I think at this point, Perry is finally giving in to his grief over Jonathan being gone. And we see that towards the end of the episode where he really just, and he's out in the middle of nowhere, so it's not like he's going to make an ass out of himself, but he really, really lets it go. Where he's so angry that Jonathan isn't there and that he's been put in the position he's in a case that he's not ready for, that he's got to find a way through and a way to win without his mentor there.
No, I'm sure. And I still think that probably he's going to have to make some more permanent peace with EB's death before the season ends.
If they go that way, what I hope we don't get is some way to, unless it's a flashback that has some substance to it, as a way to incorporate Evie or John Lithgow back into the fold. I hope they would find a less cliched way of him navigating through that than finding a way of bringing the mentor back in some capacity with some huge words of wisdom or whatnot. I'm willing to give the writers at this stage the benefit of the doubt because they've been more or less on point every step of the way. I still look at the end of episode one and the confusion over George Gannon or Matthew Dodson as the third man in the conspiracy. But since then, they've been tightening those knots up a little bit better, I've thought.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that was a pretty big issue right at the beginning, because I certainly have shared the confusion that several of the rest of you have mentioned. But since then, it seems like they've been pretty clear in what they're doing and pretty intentional in their decision making.
So the church, and Elder Seidel mentions this as Della and Perry are at the church going through the books trying to get confirmation of just how much George Gannon was on the take. And also trying to find a lead on a name or a couple of initials that are in there, JH, which they find out stands for Jim Hicks. And we had a hint in, I believe it was chapter 2, if not chapter 3, where Herman Baggerly, who we haven't seen much of since then, except for when he's been in the gallery during the trial, especially when Matthew Dodson is being cross-examined by Perry, that scene where he lays out the blueprint of their grand plan for the church being the establishment of their own town called Girard. We now have that thread getting pulled on by Della as she goes investigating more into the church, thanks to a ledger that they very deftly managed to swindle out thanks to the old hat trick.
That's right. Investigators have them for a reason.
Based on that and Pete being able to get to Denver, and I think it was because Lupe flew him out there.
Yes, I think that was the implication.
She's only in this episode for a minute or two, and it's to help prop Perry up a little bit. And then he asks her at the end of the conversation, how long is it to get to Denver, presumably by her biplane? Pete gets out there, and again, Shea Whigham really knows how to have fun in a scene, it seems like. Because he goes out and talks to an old-timer trying to get information on the two thugs that were in on the kidnapping of Charlie Dodson and gets spat on in the process. And then the conversation with the secretary in the office, and they are very murky on what that is. I think when I went back and watched it again, there was no other information than the old man sent him to this office to talk to this person to get this information.
Right. I think that Pete knows more than the audience does right now.
Yes, he does. And I had to look it up a little bit, and it was, I believe, the Ludlow Coal Company, which ties into the Ludlow Coal Massacre of 1914, which was a workers' rebellion against the coal baron who ran this operation that turned very violent. There were deaths. It was a very ugly scene. In trying to find a connection between the two thugs and Innes, he manages to find something that literally came out of the blue, and it's all because of a picture on the wall of Elder Seidel of the church.
Yes, the very same man who was so worried about Perry and Della going through the church's ledgers. I was surprised by that reveal. I don't know about you.
I was. It's knowing the difference between a red herring and a breadcrumb. And getting out to Denver, Pete went looking for one thing and found a really big breadcrumb in the process. I like those the way when you have characters who are able to weave their way into a situation with their intelligence, their street smarts, their experience, knowing what questions to ask, and knowing how to get the right information out without making it seem so obvious. as Dan Morin had talked about in chapter four, the idea of getting information via coincidence, which the characters have touched on throughout this season, especially of if it's, you can only have so many coincidences before you know you're onto something.
Exactly.
And this was a coincidence that Pete wasn't expecting, but damn, is he happy when he finds it.
Yeah. And, I have big concerns for Pete at this point. As soon as he said, get me out to Denver, my thought was, if he heads out to Denver, he's not coming back. And I still think that he may not make it back in person. I'm sure his information is going to have to get to Perry somehow, but I have big concerns for him in the last two episodes.
That's the drawback. We see him on such a high note in this episode that it almost seems inevitable there's no way for him to go but down.
And if they're looking for a big low point for the penultimate episode, it certainly wouldn't get much lower than another member of the team dying.
Yeah, or being accosted in some way that completely takes them out of the picture. It leans more towards the probability that Pete won't last to the end of the season, which I would love to see him come back in season two, but the core dynamic has always been Perry, Della, and Paul.
Right, and it certainly seems like they are setting Paul up to either be fired or resign from the police before the season's over.
And step into that role that Pete used to occupy.
Exactly.
Because this is an HBO show, and I should have seen this coming to an extent because I did watch all eight seasons of Game of Thrones. I know it's fashionable to say there were only seven. There were eight.
Or only six.
Was there seven? Okay.
No, I was just making fun of the last two seasons.
Ah, okay. Yeah, that's, you could go that way depending on your level of pushback against it. Totally get that. But the more I watch this, the more I keep thinking, oh yeah, there's the parallel between the end of season one, where we had major characters fall off in Game of Thrones, giving way to, I don't want to say lesser characters, but characters who were going to carry forward throughout the rest of the story. And we're seeing a similarity here.
Yes, particularly now that we know that they're coming back for a second season. I think it seems likely that they're setting us up for the classic trio to be the ones going forward.
Right. And now that we had the addition of Hamilton Burger last week, their D.A. Hamburger, which, how that blew by me, I have no idea. But thanks to the people in the Slack channel for reminding me of it. But in the original series, Hamilton Burger was the D.A. who usually squared off against Perry. It wasn't somebody like Maynard Barnes. So it may be on both sides that we see some attrition. If EB is gone, then by the end of this story, we may see if, and there's no reason to think it won't, when this case finally blows up in Maynard Barnes' face, that's going to be the end of him.
That definitely could be one way they go. I also wonder if he might be on the chopping block as well in these last two episodes, if he pushes Ennis the wrong way, for example.
He could, but his position seems as absolutely rock solid as possible at the end of this chapter, thanks to the testimony of the jail matron, who we have seen for the last four or five episodes while Emily was in the pokey, waiting for the trial to start, and she gets up there and completely purges herself on the stand, saying that she said that she heard Emily say that she killed Charlie, which throws the whole court into a complete cacophony. Perry and Della have to find a way to get Emily out before she is ripped apart by both the gallery and the press corps. And as Della is in the car with her, that seems to be the absolute limit of what Emily Dodson could take. Because she says to Della, it'll be fine. And Della's, of course, looking at her going, what are you talking about? It's not going to be fine. Oh, no, 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 no. When Sister Alice brings Charlie back, everybody will see it wasn't murder, because you can't murder somebody who's alive again. Uh-oh.
Yeah, she has had an incredibly rough go of it.
That's putting it mildly.
Yes. This episode certainly did not help. She has her husband yelling horrible things at her. when he was on the stand, and it just continues to get worse, and finally with this jail matron who just goes right off the deep end and just says that I heard Emily confess. And at that point, Barnes says, all right, there we go. Let's call it a day.
She loses her son. Her husband is accused of it. We find out he's not who he says he is. Then it's pinned on her. She has to go through the just utter insanity of that. She's physically assaulted by innocent Holcomb to try to fashion a formal confession out of her, which fortunately Della intervenes on. Then she's told that by Sister Alice, oh no, I can bring him back from the dead.
Sister Alice and the resurrection definitely is her only lifeline at this point. She's decided to pin all of her hopes, any hope remaining, on the belief that Sister Alice can bring back Charlie, because she has nothing else.
No, she doesn't. And again, we have 2 hours left to see how Sister Alice is going to pull this off, and more importantly, how Perry is going to pull this off.
Which I think might have to do how he's ultimately going to do it, and also it has to do with why I think Barnes has the jail matron come in to perjure herself, is the bit that we skipped over where Perry finally does present the dentures when the mortician is on
right,
the stand.
Good old Virgil.
Yes, and ultimately the judge rules it inadmissible anyway. But I think that the fact that there is other evidence out there has spooked Barnes at that point, and he wants to shore up his final case, which is why he switches away from Ennis, who he grills and doesn't stand up, to this jail matron's perjured testimony instead. Mm.
And we have seen even more of the limits Barnes will go to make it harder for Perry, because Perry manages to convince the judge to get Barnes to give over all the evidence that he had been withholding. And they take that opportunity to completely snowball Perry and Della and Pete by giving them stuff that has nothing to do with this case whatsoever, because it's tactically a smart move on their end. They could say, hey, we gave them everything that we had. They also threw in stuff from cases that had no relevance at all, which Pete points out as he's going through the boxes. And when Perry pushes back and uses the dentures as a means to try and get them in, saying, hey, it was in all the stuff that the DA gave us. And Barnes, knowing that he just took whatever he had and lobbed it all in there, you see that split second where he's like, oh crap, did I put that in there?
Right.
But again, his legal acumen and his ability to know how to navigate the system,
it's much better than Perry's, and he can jump in and ask for the sidebar right away.
Right, which, of course, Perry doesn't understand the concept of a sidebar in that you don't get to yell.
Or he does understand and wants to make sure that the jury and the press can hear that there's other evidence.
Touché. Very good point. And the analogy is there that Perry is still very much a blunt instrument here. That because he has just passed the bar, he's just got his attorney's license, and he's still thinking very much as the investigator who's just got to go out and sift through the garbage and find the information that they need. He doesn't know how to deftly maneuver through all this process like somebody like Barnes does, and that is being used as an advantage over him. He's going to have to figure it out pretty damn quick if he's going to want to win this case. But of course, first he's got to figure out how to stop a guy standing in a doorway with a rifle saying, I knew you were going to be coming looking for me, when he finally drives out to Girard and finds the man, Jim Hicks, at a house that has no real earthly business being out where it is. That's where we leave it hanging. So as we bring this one into land for this week, James, I'll ask you the same question I've asked everybody else. Where do you think this is going to go, and what sort of things would you like to see over the last two episodes.
Well, I think that it's going to turn out that Jim Hicks is actually hoping to see him and happy to have Perry there and is looking to cooperate with him because Jim has been wronged in some way by similar parties. But that's purely speculative on my part. I also have to imagine that in these last two episodes, we're going to get a little bit more on World War One and Perry's time there, because that was so heavily discussed early on, and we had those flashbacks in the second chapter, I think, or maybe the third. And I would be surprised if we don't revisit that a little bit. And then finally, I also think that the thread that was used to stitch Charlie's eyes open, which Perry stole and kept at the very beginning of the show, and at some other point really early on talked about how hard it was to try and track down where the thread came from. I hope that that comes back in some way. I don't know that it will, but I really hope that it does.
That is one aspect of the investigation that they have gotten away from. And to spend as much time as they did on it, they wouldn't have gone through all the trouble if it didn't have some relevance later on, you would hope.
I would think so. And I also noticed that they spend several seconds this episode showing us those pictures of Charlie from the autopsy again. Which very clearly, oh yeah, and very clearly have the stitched open eyes prominently right there to remind the audience about that.
You know, one of the main criticisms I've heard about this first season is the nature of the crime. Of course, it's going to elicit that sort of reaction, and we even get that in the opening statement that Barnes gives to the jury of a poor defenseless child was murdered, potentially by his mother, as I intend to prove, for the most callous and disrespectful of reasons. Yeah, it's going to get you that sort of reaction. No, nobody's going to like that. It's an unpleasant case. It makes people's stomach churn to think about the idea that a baby was killed in that sort of way. But that's the point. This stuff happens. We still don't like to think that it's possible, but it happens more than we as a culture and a society want to admit.
And they've certainly gone out of their way to show that they're not interested in a romanticized version of 1930s LA.
Again, we're 3 years into the Depression. It is ugly. It's dirty. People are hurting. Some people aren't. But the people who are still in positions of power understand that they are in very real imminent danger of losing it. And if that happens, who knows what could happen to them? We've seen the consequences of that with E.B. Jonathan. We're seeing it potentially with the church. We could see it with Sister Alice. We may even see it with Pete Strickland. God, I hope not, but it could happen. But we still have two more hours of this 8-episode first season of Perry Mason. Again, it has been greenlit for season 2, so it is no longer a mini-series. It is an ongoing series. But we will get to Chapter 7 next week. In the meantime, James Farner, welcome to the TV podcast. It was great to have you, great to talk with you, and hopefully get to talk to you again sometime.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here. And again, you know, I've really enjoyed listening to you in the season up to now, and I can't wait to hear what you do with the last two episodes.
Well, I will be back next week with Chapter 7, and until then, I'm Devin Higgins. It's been a lot of fun. I'll talk to you then. Bye.